we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Harvey Risch, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. Today, we are continuing our weekly series with various interesting and accomplished people. We've usually been talking about science and medicine and COVID topics, but that's really only a departure point of possible things that we can discuss. And if listeners have questions, please submit them at americaoutloud.news/pulse, P-U-L-S-E. I'm very pleased to introduce today's guest, Dr. Alex Washburn. Dr. Washburn is a mathematical biologist who received his PhD from Princeton University's Program for Quantitative and Computational Biology. Prior to COVID, he worked with DARPA, that's the defense agency, scientific research agency, the preempt study team, studying pathogen spillover of bat and Nipah viruses. Also, she worked on the evolutionary origins of Ebola and methods of bioattribution or determining the source of novel infectious diseases. During COVID, he was heavily involved with outbreak forecasting and management consulting before finally returning to the question of attribution and the origins of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID. So, Alex, let's start. What have you been thinking about lately?
Oh, my gosh, that's a big question. In this house of horrors I call my brain, I've been thinking a lot about what the Fed is going to say this week. It's a big week in the markets. I've also been thinking a lot about AI. There's some really active discussions about risk management in AI and what sort of scientific precedents are appropriate for thinking about AI. Is this more of like a Manhattan moment of developing new technology like an atomic bomb? Or is this like virologists and the development of gain-of-function research of concern? Or is AI something else entirely? I personally think it's more of an assembly line for digital content. But yeah, that's some of the stuff I've been thinking about lately and, you know, tip of the iceberg there.
All right. Well, you said something that struck a note for me about AI, which to me is AI is just computerized GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. That AI has programming rules made by people without studying or having expertise in the topic areas of which they're programming to apply to publicly available information that spans that and is proportional to, representative to everything that's out there on the internet that is spider searchable, web crawlable to find. And what that means is, from an epidemiologic point of view, it's all garbage, because epidemiology requires the subjects to be representative of a defined population. So if you have a defined subject matter, then you need to have the subject matter facts that are representative of all the facts in the discipline, not the fact that there are 100 books in public for a particular opinion and three against the opinion, and then the AI is just going to, you know, be proportional to the number of books there are or the number of words in the books there are, and not to the meaning of the science in the first place. So it's complete and utter garbage just to start with from a conceptual point of view, and that, of course, is then manipulated by programming that has rules that are unrelated to the science discipline as well.
You know, I think scientists will still have jobs. I think we'll still be able to innovate. But at the same time, there's some other outside of the large language models of, you know, regurgitated texts and stochastic parrots on the internet. There's also object recognition on images, and there's people using AI for self-driving cars and and phones, drones, and automobiles, all sorts of different applications for different AI as a universal function approximator to automate some processes. But I think you're absolutely right in terms of the text models that, you know, how can we communicate with a chatbot? I mean, it's remarkable what it's able to do nonetheless. It can replicate a dialect. It can write a poem in Shakespearean prose. It can, you know, that's kind of cool stuff that it can do. And there's a lot of interesting questions about where that fits in the markets too. What sort of markets will be most disrupted in a good way and which ones most disrupted in a bad way? So yeah, it's a fascinating time to be alive.
Well, I don't even think that self-driving cars based on AI is going to work. And the reason for that is that humans face circumstances that don't have solutions when they drive. For example, a truck is crowding you out of your lane, and all there is a barrier to the other side of you. And what are you going to do? Even jamming on your brakes is not going to stop you fast enough to keep from getting squished. And so the AI would have to figure out the least harmful accident conditional upon there being an accident in the first place. And things like that, maybe this is for self-driving trucks rather than self-driving cars, but still, you get the idea that there are things that are just not the logical, necessary logical, that involve value judgments that and ethical judgments and things like that, that there is no text or evidence-based body of facts from which the AI can draw some kind of optimized, model conclusions.
Yeah, I think training AI for trolley problems will open up a whole literature in and of itself. But yeah, no, it's cool to see. It's been fun to, I mean, I use AI every day. For instance, ChatGPT can help you write code. So if you know what to ask it, it can regurgitate stuff from the internet that speeds up my productivity for coding. But yeah, and you can imagine AI assisting people. There are things that like warn if events are happening around a car, or there's some, how to really plug humans into AI. And I've had hearing aids my whole life, so I like thinking about, could you use AI to make hearing aids better? Could we have some way to help better recognize sound or things like that that can or filter out noise? Yeah, so there's a lot of cool different areas out there, but the real crux for me is figuring out what's marketable and what can you own and what are the sorts of AI models that can generate their own data, or once you have them, people use them, and in the process, you get better trained data, so less garbage in and more or less garbage out.
Okay, so have you figured out a way to make AI recognize natural truth, the truths of nature, rather than opinions of people?
I don't have an answer to that. I think there's a good question about how we can try to can so this is actually interesting. I read an article about sort of the history of large language models and how historically people were trying to really impose the syntactic structure of, the semantic structure of sentences to learn how to recreate sentences, that you have to have, a subject and a verb, and you have to have these relationships between words and orders and conjugations and stuff like that. And if you went that route, you could imagine imposing formal logic. But what
Oh,
we did
no.
instead is we just scaled it up. Yeah.
Not in English. There's so many counterexamples. Flying planes can be dangerous.
Yes,
Okay.
yes.
Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. That's an example of a sentence with superficial structure and no deep structure. Superficial meaning, no deep meaning. There's enough things about how we process language that don't have one-to-one correspondences to anything that AI could actually figure out, accurately, that
I love
I.
that. And I'm not an expert. There are a lot of people. There's just like it's a fire hose trying to drinking out of a fire hose trying to keep up with the AI space. And I honestly love that. I think it's close to trying to keep up with COVID when we were, paying attention to all the literature on different clinical trials or observational ecological studies or the case reports and all the stuff that was constantly coming at us. I feel like AI is in a similar stage of really just sprinting as fast as you can to keep up. And I'm interested in seeing what people come up with next, in terms of can we provide some grounds or structures to language models so that they can at least be aware of formal logic. And there's some ways in which they recreate it. We don't know, have any way, like we wouldn't trust an LLM proof at this point in time, but are there ways to ground it so that it is bounded within these sort of logical rules that ensure that the output is trustworthy? I think that would be a cool thought for, I don't know, maybe we'll see in the next 10 years, maybe we won't.
That assumes that the people who are programming it are trustworthy and objective and apolitical and so on. And I don't think
Yeah.
anybody right now left like that. Maybe you and I are the last two people left.
There's a lot of, yeah, it's an interesting world out there. I think I kind of, I really like watching the markets bubble up, all these different innovative companies trying to come up with different business models for the use of AI. And Yeah, so that's what I'm thinking about these days a little bit, but it's been a lot. It's been definitely keeping my brain busy.
Okay. The AI, it still has, to me, real severe ethical problems, because so much of world knowledge has ethical problems in it. It has hatreds, it has biases, and so on. And AI just gobbles it all up, and it inflicts the worst part of everything that's out there without our ability to filter it. And now, of course, we found out recently that the National Science Foundation has been funding large AI projects to use for automated censorship of social media, and government-enforced censorship of social media through large AI processing. And this is completely, if this is goes on, it is completely damaging to our constitutional understanding of speech. To use
I
AI
think that's
for a
interesting.
suppression tool.
That is an interesting point. There's a great book called Algorithms of Oppression by Dr. Noble. I forget her first name. So I think Sophia Noble. But in Algorithms of Oppression, she talks how just the old search engines, for example, could preferentially rank people or sort or present images in a way that reinforced a lot of the biases that people have. Exactly to your point that humans are flawed creatures, and the algorithms we make can, if we're not careful, perpetuate those flaws. And I think you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of people in the AI space thinking about that. I think there was, I forget the exact instance, but there's a image recognition study or facial recognition study that didn't do well on some races, but did very well on white people because of the biased composition of images. And instances like that kind of reinforce your point that it will be difficult to it's a question, can we make AI better than us? That would be a nice reassurance, but if there's a decent chance we could make it much worse than us if we're not careful.
I think it is going to be, it's already shown to be so much worse than us, because of people's unbridled activism. That what's happened is the universities, and now it's moving into earlier schools, are training people to be activists first and logical, clear, objective thinkers second, if at all. And, even when I was in college 50 years ago, there was still a lot of propaganda, sloganeering, and so on, rather than analytical discussion of things. And having gone to a science school, maybe I experienced less than people at more general kinds of colleges and universities. But even so, it was still obvious. And that kind of propaganda just totally destroys an objective discussions of important things for humans to be discussing, things about values and ethics and hatreds, for that matter, too, and discrimination and all of that stuff. That you can bias it in any direction you want by propaganda, and that's been, and people, for example, 30 years ago, journalism schools, which had been turning out people trying to get at objective fact reporting, became co completely corrupted by advocacy reporting. And it said, why are you bothering to be objective and then trying to cherry pick the facts for your political opinions? You can just generate the facts in the first place and not worry about cherry picking them. And that's why nobody trusts any of the standard media today, because it's been so in your face.
I think that's it's an interesting point you make, that the internet has led this beautiful Web 2 world where we're able to share content and fora online, and we still had that Web 1, mainstream outlets that were presenting stories. They kind of had some editorial perspectives to tailor exactly what they presented and how they chose to present it, and there's some value in that. We also haven't figured it out, even as people. The COVID was a perfect example. Even without, bots flooding the scene in Twitter or anything like that, it was very difficult to have conversations, even with people who you knew were verifiable human beings. The ethics and the values discussions and the scientific debates, they were unresolved. You know, they were not easy to solve. They were not, we were not Vulcans. We were not able to just suddenly see the most reasonable path and take that. And so we're going to be training AI on that. We're going to be training AI on this Web 2 world of text and speech, or at least the large language models. And that'll be interesting to see what kind of culture it tends to pick up from that.
Well, it's going to be horrible. I mean, people assume that Google searches are objective when they're not, you know, and AI is going to be a thousandfold worse than that, because people are going to say, I got it from AI, it must be true. It would be like reading Wikipedia entries written by, and people can't even control their own Wikipedia entries because they're written by their enemies.
Yep. And, you know, I wouldn't be so, this is where I like large language models for writing code. And it's also cool where you can have text to image, where you can get a prompt and generate these really cool images. And, you know, there's a lot of other content production that we can make that's, it has its own biases and problems we're finding as well. But
you as a knowledgeable user can filter the results to know whether things are correct or not. If your program doesn't run, you know, or doesn't give you an answer that you know what the right answer is, you verify that the code is bad or the picture is bad or whatever. You know, with eight fingers on a hand, you know that the picture was bad, even if the AI couldn't figure it out. So you're able to verify the end result, whereas when you're doing exploratory AI, when you're trying to understand something, to make some, doing some research, you have no way of validating whether the results that come out are true or not.
I mean, that's true. And the internet has been a facilitator of confirmation bias in ways that AI can potentially accelerate if we're not careful. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens. And it's not just the discussion of the protocols and processes and the people developing AI, but also the ethics of us other people interacting with it. You know, what are we, in the same way we slowly and are still in the process of developing an ethos for the internet to teach people about how to search for things in ways that are likely to yield the truth, how to evaluate sources and consider competing views, and all these rules that we learn and teach each other to try to help us humans survive the world with the internet, we're going to have to develop new rules to survive a world with AI. And it'll be interesting to see what those are in terms of some of the, a lot of the stuff you're saying, and probably more beyond that.
So the main problem, as I see it, is my prediction, is that it's not just rules that we need, it's effort. That in order to validate all these things, to find out whether they're true or not, you have to use the rules, but it takes work to do that. And the last thing that people want to do is work. They want an instant result to be able to trust and know whether it's good or not. And so they're going to plug into AI, get a result, and just run with it, rather than spending the next 3 days doing all the work that's required to know whether that result was valid or not.
I mean, as a statistician, that just rings so true to me, because you see all these black box statistical software, people will just take a p-value and run with it. And I stay up at night with just the minor applications of misapplications of statistics and statistical software. But now that we're bringing that to a whole new scale with AI, it'll be, I guess to put it on a positive note, I'm grateful we live in interesting times, because there's always something to do.
All right. Well, we've actually got to a commercial break point, so let's take a pause. We'll be back shortly. So please, everybody, stay tuned.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep is infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's fast-paced digital age makes it tougher. You're not alone. Poor sleep affects over 70% of us. The CDC even labeled insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created REM Sleep to help you quickly fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake refreshed. Unlike other supplements that don't work, REM Sleep is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients, supporting all four stages of sleep using calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Over 1,000 reviews with an average star rating of over 4.4 proves it works. Take back your sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Dr. Alex Washburn. We were just talking about what I will call the pitfalls of AI. The amount of work it takes to validate that the stuff that you got quickly from AI was worth getting it quickly, and now you have to do all the work to prove that it's right, as opposed to just doing the work yourself in the first place and taking less time to do the same work yourself.
We're also discussing some promises. You know, there's some opportunities, and there will be some work for all of us cut out in the future.
I guess. maybe I'll go back to coding.
Yep.
I've written Fortran my whole life, so I don't know how good AI is going to be on Fortran. But
well, you should try ChatGPT and try to learn Python through it. It's amazing. I found that to just be such an incredible resource. You can ask it, hey, how do I simulate a data set of whatever and analyze it with Lasso or whatever, and poof.
I see. And then I can send it for publication, and nobody would be the wiser.
Yeah, this is it. The paper train. Let it begin.
That's right. So what actually prompted me to be talking to you was what you had written about the history of SARS-CoV-2, the COVID virus, and the research that went into it, all of the gain-of-function research and who did what, where, and who was connected to what. And I was totally fascinated by what you wrote. It recapitulates in one blog column what Bobby Kennedy's book on the Wuhan cover-up does in some 450 pages with tens of thousands, or it seems like, references. And this is just an amazing realization that I had from all of this, that you didn't say, and Bobby doesn't say in his book, but the conclusion that I drew from this material is that the vaccines were made as proof that the research that went into SARS-CoV-2 was not offensive bioweapon research, but dual-use research. In other words, that we have the Bioweapons Treaty from 1975 that President Ford signed, and in theory, that treaty says that it's illegal to do research to develop offensive gain-of-function bioweapons. On the other hand, it's allowed, the loophole is you're allowed to do that in small amounts in order to make vaccines. So when such an agent was determined to have leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, as we know now, as some of us knew years ago, anyway, that it became apparent that there was no vaccine, and the scrambling to make the vaccine in the year after the virus leaked was a panic reaction, along with the panic denial of the bioengineering of the virus in the first place. It was a panic reaction to prove that, oh no, this was dual use research and therefore permitted, not that it violated the bioweapons treaty. That's the law, that it was illegal to have done this. And so a vaccine had to be the end result in order to show for it. And the fact that it generated trillions of dollars of profits for the government, from, you know, pharma companies and all that, is just gravy to the system, but it's not the motivating factor. The motivating factor is to keep all those people out of jail and again, to keep the whole bioweapons business in business.
Well, there's an interesting bunch of hypotheses to unpack there. I think, that blog post was really my effort to synthesize some of what I knew from being in the community of people studying wildlife virology before COVID. And even my undergraduate thesis from 2009 was in epidemiology. So I've been very interested in this space. And even though I took a detour through models of evolution and forecasting and microbiome biostatistics, the whole time I was really interested in what was going on in epidemiology, because that's been one of my prime passions in life. And it was interesting to see that there were these major debates happening that since 2011, when Ron Fouchier and his colleagues took a avian influenza virus and passaged it through ferrets to make it transmissible in mammals, that enhanced the host, it's broadened the host range, enhanced the transmissibility of a virus that in the original form had a 50% infection fatality rate. That could be catastrophic if it got loose. And the end result, there was no guarantee that this would have a lower infection fatality rate, only that it would be more transmissible. And so conducting this research was extremely risky. And when Ron Fouchier published his paper in 2011, there was outrage in the scientific community. And this is what a lot of people who just joined us during COVID, for lack of a better word, weren't aware of, is that since 2011, there were rhetorical fistfights, so to speak, about whether or not we should conduct this research. And there's some important players and coalitions that started to form in the process of this. There were a group of people that said this is most of the time not worth the risk. Now, granted, this doesn't apply for the vast majority of research. So vast majority of biological research, like your own cancer epidemiology or people who are studying, you know, fungi in a petri dish and what they eat and how they divide and stuff like that. The vast majority of biological research is not enhancing the transmissibility, the virulence, or broadening the host range of potential pandemic pathogens. But the small subset that is taking just such an enormous risk that it deserves so much attention that the large group of people called the Cambridge Working Group organized to say, we need to better regulate this. We need to evaluate the risks and benefits of each experiment. And not do these experiments if there are less risky ways to do it, and surrogate systems that we can use to study the viruses instead. And then that seemed pretty reasonable to me. Just watching.
Yet there was never widely implemented. The Cambridge Working Group, you know, was just an academic mouthpiece of scientists that expressed its dismay and never went anywhere.
That is right. That is correct. And then in opposition to the Cambridge Working Group, there were the Scientists for Science, which that name should tell us all. You know, the Cambridge Working Group said, all right, we're in Cambridge and we're working together as a group. You know, but Scientists for Science was this nakedly political title of a group that was effectively the boys will be boys of science. They said, don't worry, we've got it covered. We can do this in ways that are not going to risk causing a pandemic. Trust us. They didn't have any evidence to assure us that. The Cambridge Working Group, meanwhile, pointed to very real lab accidents with very serious pathogens as evidence that this research could and did risk causing a pandemic. But then the Scientists for Science said, nah, that's not going to happen. Don't worry, we got it. What we really need is we need more funding so that we can have more safer facilities, better trained staff, and more of this research. So that way we can understand what happens with viruses. And the interesting thing was they couldn't actually say any benefits. They said specifically, well, we haven't actually found, no, there's no benefits yet. There's nothing we've done, but these benefits are unanticipated. This is the beauty of science, is you never know what you're going to find. And so the one experiment they were defending was they found this influenza virus, and then they made it more like they resurrected the 1918 influenza virus that killed as many people as World War II. And then they made these viruses the contemporary virus more like the 1918 virus and found that it made it worse. And so what do you expect? That was a very anticipated finding. There is no benefit there. And, you know, these.
And then they published the sequences so that anybody could make it in their garage.
And for me personally, as a private citizen, a disconcerting aspect of this was the release of information that provided protocols for people for how to do this stuff. Not only were they doing it so that if an accident happened, not only could there be a massive loss of life, but it could damage trust in science. It could just be catastrophic. I mean, it could be like COVID. 20 million people could die. It could lead to distrust of scientists. It could either A, if the lab was immediately transparent, said, I'm sorry, this was us, then immediately there would be strict regulations of that research. I think people would be very unhappy realizing that loved ones died because of an accident that someone took, overseas or in another country or wherever it happened. And I think that the geopolitical tensions that could cause could be enormous. And so that was just not, a lot of these were not really factored in or considered at the hearts by these people proposing, let's just do this. And so they had this moratorium on gain-of-function research of concern that was overturned, saying it won't be gain-of-function research of concern if you enhance the transmissibility or virulence of a potential pandemic pathogen or broaden its host range in the effort to make a vaccine, exactly as you said. And I won't use the word bioweapon because I think, you know, I think the main point here is that we made a dangerous thing. It was a dangerous biological thing, and there was a very severe risk that this dangerous biological thing could cause a pandemic, even if there was zero intentions at all to ever weaponize it or to use it in any way. But if it was entirely biodefensive, we took a massive risk. And that risk, it doesn't matter if it's a weapon, if 20 million people die. If I say, 20 million people die by accidental, you know, raining fire due to an experiment gone wrong, then people would still be upset, even if that wasn't intended as a weapon.
Well, we accidentally dropped this nuclear bomb, you know, on Dallas, and sorry, it was an accident. I mean,
and this kind of gives us respect for other fields that have been able to mitigate most of the risks. You know, nuclear energy is overwhelmingly safe. Because of the seriousness that a lot of the nuclear safety community brings to this work. And while there are some very memorable and noteworthy incidents that happened from Chernobyl to Fukushima, every one of those incidents is caused for the whole safety community to just study it intensively and to try to work on ways to mitigate that risk in the future. And what we see with COVID instead is a lack of transparency from the labs that were studying coronaviruses, not just coronaviruses, but SARS coronaviruses, and not just SARS coronaviruses, but bat SARS coronaviruses, including the closest relative to SARS-2 at the time, and likely the progenitor of SARS-2 as well. But these labs have not been transparent. And as a consequence, we've also seen this this rise of people that were calling a lab origin theory a conspiracy theory, which it never was, or saying a lab origin is implausible with reasons that didn't hold. And many of these papers saying it's a conspiracy theory or implausible were being elevated and sent out by the funders of exactly this research. And as you start to know the players of who's doing what here, you realize, wait a minute, these are all the scientists for science. These are all the people that lobbied on behalf of this work, or the funders who overturned the moratorium on gain-of-function research, or the funders like Jeremy Farrar that had a Wellcome Trust who advocated on behalf of this and said that it's worth the risk to do this work, all of whom were connected to the Wuhan Institute of Virology by their funding of EcoHealth Alliance and their study of bat SARS coronaviruses in Wuhan. So when you start to figure out who's who, it really looks even more disconcerting than just, you know, scared scientists saying this is a lab leak, because I think many are saying that the lab leak is implausible or a conspiracy theory. It seems like they may have more reputational risk realizing that the rhetorical fist fights from 2014 could come back to bite them, that their efforts to promote this research may look horrible and horribly miscalculated in light of a lab accident that kills 20 million people.
Well, this is my point. I think it does. I think the public should be clamoring for the right to shut down this research, that this is the public is largely funding the research, that it is a value judgment about the risk a society wants to take, and the society is the one who has the right to determine that risk and whether it goes forward or not, not the scientists who want to do it because promotions of their careers, their jobs, their interests, their, you know, their ideologies, whatever it is that makes it exciting for them, you know, notorious for them. Every time one of these dangerous virus papers gets published, the scientists think of themselves as the shining black knight of death, you know, and get all this attention, which is what they're really craving. And there's no relationship to sanity in this whole process.
And I think you hit a nail on the head here, which is that I think it's important for the public to be more aware, or to be made aware by, you know, by scientists acting on a civic duty as publicly or federally funded scientists, to educate the public about the risks of this research, that we shouldn't just be duking this out between the Cambridge Working Group and Scientists for Science, that clearly this affects everyone in the whole world. And I think we need to be considering that broad global world of stakeholders, including the vast majority of members of the public, who don't really gain anything from this research, but do get exposed to many of the externalized risks of a pathogen that gets let loose.
Well, I'm an idealistic scientist in that I think knowledge of how nature works is a value, whether or not it has utility, that we've pushed, you know, the design of the universe into our consciousness in so many ways that it just never ceases to amaze me how much we as human beings, part of the universe, know about how the universe works. And so I'm all for knowledge for its own sake, but I'm not for knowledge that has a cost of the kind that we experienced in COVID. And as much as Peter Daszak and his grants claimed that they were going to try to spray an infectious vaccine in the caves in China to outcompete the viruses that are in the caves, even though those viruses only infect bats and have not been able to gain the host range into mammals or humans, they wanted to use that as a motivation for a product, a benefit of this dangerous research. And I think, was it DARPA or one of the agencies said, no, it's too dangerous. And they didn't get funded. And then they likely used Chinese money to actually do what they did. And that's where we got SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah, so I was working at Montana State University before the pandemic on figuring out which pathogens come from which organisms and the evolutionary histories of Ebola and stuff like that. And I helped the team write the successful DARPA preempt grant, which is the same grant call to which Peter Daszak proposed the diffuse grant. And the diffuse grant is where they said, we're going to find bat SARS coronaviruses in Southeast Asia, ship them to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, look around for proteolytic cleavage sites, add these proteolytic cleavage sites to the exact place where SARS-2 has a proteolytic cleavage site, and do this all by, you know, creating a full-length DNA clone of the virus, and SARS-2 has evidence of assembly as a full-length DNA clone, or we have evidence consistent with assembly as a full-length DNA clone. And so that grant is super relevant, and I was in the exact same community that I was working in before COVID. And so I do feel some obligation to sort of help the public understand this. And to DARPA's credit, they invented the internet and they rejected diffuse. And so I think they did the right thing there. But in 2019, the diffuse PIs, the people who wrote diffuse, were receiving funding from NIAID. That's Anthony Fauci's agency, the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And they haven't been fully transparent about why they were being funded for that work. But in 2016, Fauci and Collins overturned the moratorium on gain-of-function research of concern, Daszak wrote them, this is great news. This is fantastic news that our funding pause, gain-of-function funding pause, has been lifted. And that is the grant that went on to fund the diffuse PIs in 2019. And so there's some unfortunate circumstantial evidence that I think is worth further investigation about what exactly they were funding in 2019 and what they were doing in 2019. And the researchers involved have not been transparent. Daszak himself didn't even disclose the diffuse grant. He withheld that even when he was being the U.S. emissary to the World Health Organization's COVID origins investigation or the Lancet's investigation and more. So I think we have a lot more stones to unturn in this episode.
Yes, I definitely agree. Well, we got to another commercial breakpoint, so let's pause here and we'll be back shortly.
Many voices, one freedom, united in the First Amendment. Our goal is to herald the voice of genuine liberty at AmericaOutloud.news, a place where you'll find the naked truth expressed with a patriotic heart. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
You've all heard Dr. McCullough and others share over and over the value of keeping your sinuses cleansed. It's a smart move all year, but even more so when we're cooped up inside. it's not really open for debate any longer. Those that live smart and live well pay attention to nasal and oral hygiene. Cofix RX has just the tools for the job with our nasal and throat cleanse. Click the Cofix RX banner on AmericaOutloud.shop to get 20% off your entire order. That's right, AmericaOutloud.shop. Use coupon code OUTLOUD. That's coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off your entire order.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Dr. Alex Washburn. We were just talking about gain of function and the pause from 2014 to 2017 in the Obama administration. My understanding is that the pause was never rescinded. It just quietly died on its own, and because Fauci just started refunding things related that would not have been funded before and never put them through the regulatory review as gain-of-function research, which he was required to do anyway. So he just skirted it, and nobody ever pushed back on that.
Well, this is where I'll be honest, that I don't know the full history of what went on behind the scenes in these decisions, other than there was a board, the NSABB, that said, here's one recommendation that you could implement that we think would be reasonable. As far as I understand it, was saying that it wouldn't be gain-of-function research of concern if you did this work with the purpose of making a vaccine. And then other agencies like DARPA or, you know, like DOD or others could have, if they wanted to, adopted that language, but they didn't. The agency that did do that was NIH and then NIAID. And so they became sort of the dual-use research of concern agency that, you know, had the policy that they were okay funding this research if you were developing vaccines. And the preempt grant, which again was not funded by DARPA, but whose PIs, the diffuse grant that was not funded by DARPA, but was funded, had the PIs funded by NIAID later, that grant proposed to make a vaccine. It was making a wildlife transmissible vaccine with the purpose of preempting pathogen spillover by preventing bats from getting sick with the more transmissible versions of these viruses. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot that I personally, as a private citizen, would love to know in terms of how did we make that decision? And not only the original decision to overturn the moratorium, but then when these proposals hit the desk of NIAID, did they do what they had promised, which is send these to the appropriate review committees? Did those review committees look at this, and why did they evaluate this was worth the risk? This is not making a vaccine for a human SARS coronavirus. Had they already documented a SARS coronavirus with one of these cleavage sites, and they're like, oh, shoot, we need a vaccine for that. If not, then why were they proposing to make one, to make a vaccine for something that had not yet been documented in nature? There's a lot of questions, and we can disagree about how a board or a committee would make a decision, but I still think it'd be worthwhile to understand the reasoning that led to this series of events here.
I agree with you, and I think we're never going to get that information. Those people will, that's their hill to die on, to suppress that because of their feelings of vulnerability for having caused this calamity, you know, because of their bad decisions and trying to protect themselves and their industry, which now the public should be expressing complete outrage over. And, you know, again, they've got the media so corrupted, the standard media so corrupted, that it's probably suppressing most of that outrage. So most people don't even know that, you know, your column and Bobby's book and all of that are still a very limited distribution.
Yeah, and I think your point about the media is, you know, I've always read mainstream outlets and I love them and I grew up with them and, you know, I still value some components of them, but COVID has been it's changed my view of them entirely, both in terms of their coverage of the epidemiology and the science of behind the outbreak, where they would kind of pick and choose which scientists they would want to represent. There were paradigm splits everywhere and they would just find the paradigm that was held by, I don't know, Anthony Fauci or whoever had a lot of power and connections to the media outlets. And that was the only side of the science that they presented. And with COVID origins, it was the same thing, where when you had a paper claiming dispositive evidence that disposed of a lab origin theory because of cases clustered around a wet market, that was covered in the New York Times and the Guardian and the Atlantic. in all of these major outlets, but that paper hasn't withstood the test of time. In fact, right when it was released, it was immediately apparent that the case ascertainment was extremely biased. They were only looking for cases with associations to the wet market. So, of course, those cases are going to be centered around a wet market. And there were earlier cases preceding the wet market outbreak, and there was additional evidence from Weibo social media analyses that suggested there were earlier searches and surges of care-seeking terms on the other side of the river, closer to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, prior to the wet market outbreak. So this evidence doesn't align.
And they paralleled Wuhan subway line too.
Yeah, and so
which is the one that goes from, passes the WIV and goes to the airport.
And this is exactly right. None of that stuff that we're saying here in opposition to the War of Vietnam paper claiming dispositive evidence, or the Wuhan wet market as the Huanan seafood market as the origin, none of the competing claims are ever given airtime. As a consequence, if you only read the mainstream outlets, you get an extremely biased view of the scientific paradigms and possibilities. And that I became very cynical about that. And then I realized you could just trade it in the stock market instead, because if they're covering this paradigm and only this paradigm, but another paradigm actually has more evidentiary support, and you trade on behalf of this paradigm, and you're more likely to win. If the truth will out, which it will in science, then eventually it becomes known that this outbreak forecast was correct, even though this was...
I wish I knew how to invest in that. I'd put some of my retirement funds in it.
Yeah, I mean, I helped a hedge fund short the market, and all this continued all the way through to what I called the Omicron strategy, where there were different views on the probable burden of successive outbreak cycles. You know, there was the original wave, then there was the Alpha, then Delta, and then Omicron. And many people thought that Omicron was the first immunoevasive variant, and oh my gosh, this could cause a whole new pandemic. And so life insurance stocks plummeted because people thought a lot of people are going to die. There's going to be many claims. This is going to be disastrous for life insurance companies. But I was doing the accounting and I was doing the careful examinations of the competing paradigms and found there's a lot more support for the other hypothesis, which was Delta was actually the first outbreak with waning immunity, evidenced by the Provincetown findings by the CDC, finding 100% waning immunity in people who received vaccines. And Delta had lower burden than the pandemic wave, indicating that Omicron, too, may have lower burden as immunity continues to accumulate. And so it wasn't the first immunoevasive strain, so to have less people dying with the Delta wave. And as a consequence, I bought a bunch of life insurance stocks. And when the market dropped by 20%, the life insurance stocks went up by 40%.
I think you ought to sell them now, because life insurance is going to start plummeting again as the excess mortality and cancer occurrences start to rise.
Yeah, that I exited the position, and now I just have a more balanced and chill portfolio. So maybe thinking about AI and other things out there. But that was interesting for me to see that the mainstream media's coverage of the science of COVID was so biased that even though many scientists knew, oh my gosh, a pandemic was coming in February of 2020, they couldn't say it out loud, partly because of social pressures within science and partly because there was not a lot of media incentive. People who did speak up.
The French knew in fall of 2019. The French knew in November of 2019 and maybe October of 2019. The Minister of Health in France, Agnès Buzyn, changed the prescription, the availability of hydroxychloroquine from over-the-counter to prescription only, because they knew not only that it worked, but that it would solve the pandemic. And there goes the vaccine, and there goes the support of the bioweapons industry. And so she had to do that for the same, not just for the financial reason that it cost 40 cents or 80 cents a dose a day, to treat COVID, but that if 95% of people can be treated that way, then what do you need a vaccine for? The vaccine's not going to be seen to be the solution to the pandemic. Therefore, there wasn't dual use. Therefore, it was only an offensive, agent and so on, the whole chain of reasoning.
I mean, that's interesting. And I think that seems like a fair hypothesis, that if there were ways to sort of make up for this accident, to say, it's okay, no, this is worth it. Fauci has overseen the U.S. biodefense spending since the anthrax attacks in 2001. And we don't have brand new vaccines. Our life expectancies have not dramatically increased. And then now we have an accident, what is probably an accident in Wuhan, that may well have received funding from Anthony Fauci's NIAID. So you could imagine there being some incentives to, or at least some conflicts of interest in the people who are in charge of this, believing that they somehow needed to make up for it. And I think that's a fair hypothesis. I also think the hydroxychloroquine issue is an interesting one, because there were those studies in, it was January or February of 2020, showing that at least in cell culture, hydroxychloroquine was effective at reducing viral titers.
It was known since 2005. The chloroquine studies from CDC authors from 2005 were known that exactly what you just said, that the Chinese had it in their treatment guides from February of 2020, chloroquine, that... And every study that came out shows that in the first 2 years, it worked very well in keeping people out of the hospital and keeping them from dying. In Omicron, there's less evidence, no studies, but before Omicron, this was very well established. Now we now have 70,000 patients in 10 or 11 studies that looking at hospitalization and mortality. Every one of them shows 75% benefit against mortality.
Yeah, and I think this is the stuff that I love as a scientist. I love different views, you know, and I love hearing your reasoning here. It's just very valuable to hear the steel man for that case. And I remember when hydroxychloroquine showed efficacy in SARS-2 in February of 2020, I believe, or March of 2020, sometime early pandemic, it seemed totally fair that could be something to try, that should be something that we should have clinical trials for. I know Remdesivir had their clinical trials slated to be done by late April of 2020. And it seemed reasonable to me, okay, we'll take all these drugs that did well in cell culture and get clinical trials for all of them in a way that gives an equal comparison and fair comparison. But it did seem strange to me that there was such a strong objection and resistance to hydroxychloroquine. That was unusual to me as a kind of a social observation as a scientist in the field, that seemed like a fair hypothesis. And so, and there was one study based on a flawed data set or something like that, that people said, therefore everything is flawed. That's not right. You know, that's just because one person.
Now, that was the fake Surgisphere papers. There were three of them, one in Lancet, one in New England Journal, and one as a preprint that on ivermectin that disappeared quickly also. And they were all fake data. And we don't have a chain of money linkage to why those authors did that, but they certainly had some reason to put out to make fake papers to try to pervert the knowledge base and therefore terrify the whole population over this. And the amazing thing is that when I did my first research on hydroxychloroquine in May of 2020 and published that and got an article in Newsweek saying we should be using this because it is a completely harmless medication, that even if it doesn't work, even if we don't have proof that it works, it costs so little and has some evidence that, you know, even then that it's good, that we should be trying this. And what I got, the pushback that I got in the media was, well, here's a study of hospitalized patients and it didn't work there. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I said explicitly in outpatients, and you're coming back, you media people are coming back and saying in hospitalized patients, it's a different disease. Why is that of relevance? Why? And I said, this is a big lie. Okay. So by June or July of 2020, I knew that there were big lies in COVID. And I could not understand why we were dealing with big lies then and who was pushing big lies and why the media and others were totally, you know, subscribed to these big lies.
I think, and that is an unsettling possibility, that I felt that too, you know, as a scientist, something strange happened, you know, where suddenly there was this extreme top-down dictation of what was allowable science and what was not. And it came out of nowhere. And when that started happening, it was extremely hard as an independent scientist to engage in the kinds of discourse that was commonplace before COVID. And I know science has always been a little bit ugly, but it was nothing like what happened during COVID, when suddenly you start getting people writing articles and, I mean, just having actual mainstream outlets or places like Slate or Vox or whatever, right, really biased perspectives on this scientific dispute. They didn't actually seem to be eager to understand the nuts and bolts and the core of what was going on or present it in a way that helped the public prepare and hedge bets across these possible outcomes of which paradigm wins in the future. But instead, they said, this is the message. This is the message that cases are going to double every 6.2 days, that the case fatality rate is 3.4% until we say otherwise, you know. And if you, the Gangout sero survey of 0.4% infection fatality rate, no. Ionitis and Unitas and then the study in Santa Barbara, no. Don't, you can't use that, you know. But they could cherry pick a single study that showed that your hydroxychloroquine didn't work, or they could cherry pick a single study out of Manaus, the city in Brazil, and it was a sero survey in Manaus. There were two sero surveys in Manaus. One of them, they knocked on doors and they sampled people randomly in the population. The other, they drew from the blood bank at a hospital at a time when the hospital is saturated with COVID patients. And so which of these two studies do do people use to try to reject these hypotheses about, you know, T cells or other kinds of immunity? They used the one from the blood bank that was drawing on only hospitalized patients that, similar to hydroxychloroquine issues, you know, the application of exclusively an inpatient population to projecting that to outpatient dynamics for seroconversion or to the efficacy of treatments and more. That's an extrapolation that I'm hesitant to make, but.
Well, it's fraud. I call that fraud. Okay. It's fraud for some ulterior motive that has nothing to do with the actual science or the meaning or the evidence for what's being represented.
Well, I think some scientists were caught up in this, you know, and they were just looking around at their colleagues and they're reading only the titles and the abstracts, and they're in a social network with their close friends that all listen to the same news and follow the same sources. And there was this groupthink. So I think that a lot of people were well-meaning, but the effect of this for people like you and me who have the fault of independence and a willingness to say, hey, I think I see something, even if it sticks our necks out.
Right. I know. I tell people everybody needs a plan B. If you're going to be contrary to the public messaging, you need a backup system for maintaining yourself. That is true. Yep.
In my case, it was finance, and that was fun. That was, at least it was another outlet where hedge funds really cared, because they cared about what is actually going to happen, because that will actually determine the future prices and that will actually determine macroeconomic forecasts. And so it was interesting to be able to show them sort of the dynamics and the guts of what's happening in science and to reveal to them this strange culture of what was happening in terms of the presentation of the biased presentation of evidence and paradigms.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm glad that worked for you and tided you through. That's amazing. So it turns out we're actually out of time now. And this time just goes by very quickly. I hope everybody enjoyed our discussion. And again, if you have questions, please submit them at americaoutloud.news/pulse. So Alex, thank you for some really great conversation. Thanks to everybody for listening, and please come back again next week.